Welcome to The Cannabis Professor, a marijuana science and culture podcast broadcasting from the state of Pennsylvania to the rest of the nation and the world. Well, I'm Scott, your cannabis professor, and today I am absolutely excited because we're finally able to forge into a topic that I have not really been able to talk about with any level of responsibility, and that is growing tactics, growing cannabis, plant growth in general. Now, we've mentioned it here and there in some episodes, kind of in the shadows, but today I'm very happy to have a special guest on who is an expert in this field and is going to help us understand a lot more about growing soil and what kind of factor it is in cannabis growth, and then beyond that, in just botany overall. So let me introduce, with great excitement, Lee Spivey, the head of marketing of Good Earth Organics, to the show. Lee, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Scott. Appreciate you.
Right on, right on. And Lee, if you want to take a second and just let some folks know about your background in really soil, I guess. I know a lot of folks love the green parts, right? A lot of people think of the buds at the end. But how did you become such an expert in soil?
That's a good question. So I've been growing since 2005. And my first year, we just kind of dug holes in the ground and, you know, grew plants in it and didn't have much. I mean, obviously, they worked well. Things, you know, you can grow that way. And then we found a company called Good Earth Organics, and the soil that they had to offer was much better than what we were using in the ground. You know, they had sourced ingredients from around the world, built it in a manner that worked well for the plant, and the chemistry and the ingredients behind it really helped us improve our growth. And so we used that soil for about 5 years before I started working for the company. And it's interesting because my wife actually applied for the job and they asked who the grower was, and it was me. And so they urged us to go ahead and have me come in. But yeah, here I am today, 8 years later. So I worked retail for the company for about 6 years and five and a half years. And, after doing that, you learn all about the products, right? You learn how the manufacturing process goes. You learn all the input ingredients. You learn how they're all blended together. You learn the process from start to finish. And you have to talk about it on a consistent basis daily for 5.5 years. And so really, that's where my soil knowledge came from, was from the owner, from Roy Leon, who started this company, and from his associates who helped him build it up.
No, that's awesome. So really, it's sort of the opposite of what I have, where I've read a lot, seen a lot of pictures, heard a lot of stories, but you really worked through cultivation into soil, kind of really touching every step, it sounds like. So when I initially was trying to get a little bit of background info, so I didn't sound like such a layman, I saw that obviously I was going to put in the title, you know, everything you need to know about weed, dirt, or something fun, but that is not really a responsible term. So to really start off, I thought, what's the difference between dirt and soil so that people actually know what they're talking about?
That is an excellent question. So dirt is what you pick up off the ground, right? It's what gets stuck in your boots. It's what you take with you when you drive down the road and leave a dirty place. That's dirt. What we make is soil. So potting soil or growing media, if you will. What we do is we take the best input ingredients that are organic from around the world, and we source them, put them into our facility in Cave Junction, Oregon, where we're based. And we handcraft it to be the most premium organic growing media that we can find or purchase.
So knowing that a part of your tagline, which I was actually very, very big fan of, says that you are committed to making premium organic products that are good for the plants and the planet. You know, I think the bell went off in my head that a lot of people do, where it was like, well, I understand there's better and there's worse, but it seems like there are actually things that are worse for the plant, not just not as good, but actually bad for the plant and the planet. So as you said, you source a lot of organics around the planet. What are some other ways that, I guess, soil comes about where it's not as good for it? Like, what kind of things differentiate quality soil?
That's a good question. So a lot of people, companies will source fir barks and things like that that are a little too acidic. They'll use chemical compounds in their nutrient packages that go into that soil that can leach harmful stuff into the environments. Things like that, you know, the different erosions that are happening around the world, you really need to be able to give back to the planet in a way where the soil is giving back to the dirt, so to speak, right? Like, okay. So what we make goes back to the planet in a way where the growing media itself, once it's done being used, gets composted and turned back into dirt.
All right, on. So there is a cycle kind of from soil to dirt and back again. It isn't necessary that dirt is dirt, soil is soil. They kind of can move around a little.
Well, once the soil is built and created and it disposed of, it then becomes carbon material after a while going back to the earth, right? So we never take dirt and put it into our soil, but our soil does end up eventually becoming dirt.
Right. A little bit, I guess, less useful for the sort of things we think about, especially. So I see behind you in the video that we have going on, and I saw in some of the literature that it said that you are, at least the soil that is used is a grower's choice in the Emerald Triangle. For those who don't know, what is the Emerald Triangle and how important is that for cannabis?
So it's actually pretty super important for cannabis. It's where the best cannabis in the world is produced. The Emerald Triangle started out as a tri-county thing in California. Mendocino, Humboldt, and Trinity counties was the original Emerald Triangle. And as laws progressed and got less viable for California growers, the California growers from those areas started moving into my neck of the woods. And therefore, by them traveling up into our areas in the Josephine counties and Jackson counties in Southern Oregon, which is just across the border from Northern California.
So it's just nestled up right against it, yeah.
Right. And so those growers came up here and extended that Emerald Triangle to our area.
Okay. So it actually ended up extending it a little bit. Regulation once again, popping its head in a little bit and showing the flow is usually in response to it. So the best cannabis comes from there. Is it usually indoor or is it outdoor, would you say, produces, in your humble opinion, the best cannabis?
That's a big debate, my friend. So I've had really great indoor and really great outdoor. In fact, I was at a farm this last weekend, just after the Emerald Cup over there in Calaveras County, California, that is producing some of the best outdoor I've ever seen. I mean, beyond comparable to any indoor. And it's nice to see the practices that they're using and stuff like that. But then I've also, the cups, they're indoor cups, right? So the indoor is the most sought after form of cannabis for sure. Even though a lot of people think they're smoking indoor, probably actually smoking outdoor.
A guy with your experience and background, can you flashpoint just tell, looking at a strain, interacting with it, which way it went? Or is it possible to kind of create a similar overall look? I know not necessarily end product, but look in the plant.
Most of the time, I would say yes. I can tell the difference between a light dab, a greenhouse, outdoor, an indoor, deep water cultivation, living soil grown.
Oh, wow. Really? So you really stratify it down.
Tell the difference, and there's a Ganja program now out there that's happening that's similar to the wine sommelier and stuff like that. And so it's definitely good to know all this stuff when it comes down to being like a bud tender or stuff like that, where you need to let people know how, if, when, where, things like that. And so it definitely matters. But to get back to the point, you can definitely tell the difference if you're familiar and have the experience. But most people that are just basic consumers aren't going to be able to tell the difference between a really well outdoor grown cannabis plant that's in the dispensary and an indoor grown one. They're going to look very similar, smell very similar on the shelf.
Although it's a little techie for people who are into growing, this is probably a great one. Can you also tell similarly the difference between a plant grown through photo periods and one that was an autoflower with a little bit of ruderalisin? Does that change enough of the plant where there's a way of seeing characteristics?
Yes. Those are a little easier to tell the difference.
Okay, really?
So the photo period plants are definitely going to come to more fruition. They're going to get harder, denser, bigger. They're going to be smellier, tastier, just because they're photo period plants. They're not dictated by a genetic, right? They're dictated by the genetics matter, obviously, but they're not going to just finish out on you without you finishing them, right?
So yeah, the environment's huge in that.
Yeah, you can control your grow more with a photo period plant than you can with an autoflower.
So it's definitely, I guess the best cannabis is going to come through the photo period side of it, obviously, since you can really mess with environmental factors too. Oh, that is awesome. So as I mentioned, we haven't had too much grow knowledge on the show. I've taught a lot of it from a distance, five basic phases, seed, seedling, all the way through veg. But when somebody like you thinks about growing, do you think about in the same five steps, or do you focus more on certain areas where some people don't think so much?
There's a good amount of steps involved with my process. Obviously seed to harvest is the biggest process there. But then there's the curing, the storing, the trimming, stuff like that. And so it all matters from a consumer standpoint. I find that a lot of cannabis in other states that are still pretty young markets have a little bit more work to do in the curing and the trimming process and things like that in order to get their product up to the quality that I'm used to personally. But they're doing a pretty good job so far.
In PA, I can say with absolute honesty that, yeah, the first year we called them pinch buds because as soon as you would pop them, it's just powdered sugar almost. No real structure. They were dried within inches of their lives. And then we saw, I'm sure something you're familiar with, Humidipax, Bevitapax, Boost, whatever they want to call them, return into them. And I kind of felt like it was a little bit of back and forth. Like, is it over dry potentially? Are you a person who likes the idea of returning humidity to it? Or do you think like the best cannabis is cured well? You don't really need to do that.
That's a good question. You know, the environment matters 100% in that scenario, right? So obviously Bevita got it right. They have a pack that's 62% humidity. That's my preferred humidity. Okay. I think that keeping it at that level is preferred. If you need to dry it out a little more to have it trim better, do so, but definitely rehydrate it back to 62%. You know, 55 is great for trimming. They do have 55% Bevita packs that work well for the trimmer in the hand. But the 62% is really where it's at for that bag appeal, that smell, that terp level, all that stuff.
Awesome. Do you find, you know, given almost every step affects the plant, right? But obviously, if you screw up at the beginning, you're never going to reclaim some of the, I guess, possible benefits of the plant since they never grew. Is it, you know, and I'm sure it's market dependent, but do some jars ruin the product as far as not just storage, but like getting pulverized, getting staticked on the way? I'm sure most trucks aren't refrigerated. So, you know, it's going through a temperature cycling. Do you find that, you know, cannabis can be sort of destroyed so much in the post that it can ruin a lot of what growers like you were trying to do?
I think that is possible if you didn't take the proper steps in order to ensure your product is viable through transportation. You know, there's definitely things you can do in the sealing and the retention of the product itself, right? The terpenes and the trichromes and things along those lines that definitely get knocked around during transportation.
How do you store your weed by chance?
I keep it in, you know, turkey bags, in totes and black trash bags. So in the turkey bag, inside the black trash bag, inside of a tote.
Yeah. No lights getting into there, obviously.
Right. Yeah. No light. You keep the humidity well, you know what I mean? Keep Bovita packs in there so it doesn't, but it also breathes, you know, you got to make sure that there's some transference of environment, you know, otherwise you're going to create bad environments inside your bag, right?
Yeah, overly humid, right? Because it's still changing even though it's dead in that way, you know, it's still going through a process. I actually ran into a guy I know who does a little home grow, and I asked him about soil, knowing that we're going into this. He didn't have any questions right off the bat, but I thought I'd ask more so on his behalf, knowing each step has its sort of nuances. Where do you find a lot of people ignore a certain amount of focus in growing cannabis? Where's a misconception or a mistake that you find is commonly made?
I find the most common mistakes are made in the pest prevention and transition stages of growing. So especially in the organic realm of things where you're not having necessarily a bioavailable product that is pushing your plant in an immediate fashion. You're having to preemptively feed and plan for the transition of the plant from veg to bloom, right? And so you're gonna work that soil in a manner where you're putting the nutrients into it a couple weeks ahead of time so that it has time to break down, become bioavailable, and let that plant grow at its maximum rate. And so a lot of people will find that they have larfier cannabis or less cola formations on their plants because they didn't preemptively get that transition in time.
So if they're a little late to the game, it's like stunning the growth of the plant in a way. It doesn't have what it needs when it needs it the most. So you get minimal gains instead of maximized gains in that.
That's right.
Incredible. So that really brings us, and you kind of mentioned it, you know, obviously the quality and timing. So I ran into, of course, I'm sure people have heard about it, living soil as an idea. I looked into it just basically, it kind of seems like the top of the mountain. A lot of people say living soil with like a breathy, like they're mentioning almost like a religious figure. So what's so special about living soil, and is it the top of the market? Is the other soil dead or zombie soil comparatively?
That's an interesting phrase, zombie soil. So most soil is going to have some form of life in it, whether it's living microbiology or not. It's going to have a nutrient content that's going to feed the plant, right? But living soil is a formation of living organisms within the soil that help break down the nutrients and help the plant uptake more of it, right? So a living soil is going to take the organics in the soil, break them down into the root zone or the rhizosphere, and help everything be put into the roots, so to speak, so where the plant has it available, not just, it's feeding time, like it's constantly available. So a plant can eat whenever it wants. And so the plant develops in a natural way without being forced and without being synthetic, right? So living soil really allows the plant to work at its own rate in a vigorous manner without pushing it in a synthetic way.
What do you have to do? Do you have to maintain living soil, or is that something where you can kind of set it and forget it? Is it adding in like little mites or nutrients to it over time, or does it kind of take care of itself?
So living soil, basically you need to keep feeding with either compost, teas, or organics in a fashion that have, you know, microbiology in it, mycorrhizas, bacillus, trichoderma, streptomyces, things like that, to where you're giving the soil more life constantly, right? Because it will always have living organisms in it, but we need to outcompete the bad organisms with the good organisms, right? Because microbiology, it lives, it's all living, you know, just like humans, there's good humans and bad humans. So we want good humans in a bigger population so that the world can thrive, right?
We're having trouble with that, it seems, nowadays, but I agree. Yeah, we need some living soil on this side of the pot as well. Exactly. I like that. So is it possible to get a lower quality or a less living soil? Can you add in some of those same strategies and get it upgraded to a much better environment?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can take any pretty much soil, like, or just cocoa, and add compost, add a mix of things that allow drainage, things like that. And you can turn pretty much anything into a living soil. Especially if you're, you know, using forest humus, things like that, that already have all that living microbacteria in it that you're putting into your soil. Compost is one of the things that has the most. Biochar is a great thing to add. It holds a lot of living organisms in it. Like one little chunk of biochar can hold millions of living bacteria.
Holy. In it. So very valuable.
Very valuable. So it's not hard to create a living soil. Now, our living soil is a little more difficult to create, because it has such a high release NPK in it. It's developed specifically for cannabis to grow at its most vigorous rates. It's been tested by third-party professors out of South Carolina that give us 50% more growth than the competitors, stuff like that. So it's been developed purposefully to be the premier soil on the market at the moment.
As the cannabis plant goes through its growth, living soil or other, the plant, obviously, as it grows, it what it needs changes. Does a grower have to strategize by changing out the soil completely, or just adding different things to the soil through its life cycle?
Great question. So our soils come with enough nutrient to get you through into transition, whether you're growing outdoors or indoors or light depth. They're there in the soil and ready. We also have a line of top dress and compost tea nutrients, which give back to that living soil and keep it alive. Now, when you're done with the run, so to speak, and your nutrients are depleted, we have a boost, a product that regenerates the soil nutrients and allows you to continue using that same soil for 5-6 runs without having to purchase more soil, right?
Right.
But eventually everything degrades back into carbon, and you'll have to re-amend that growing media with substrate and things like that that help the drainage and get the media back to where the roots can be held by it.
When you're doing outdoors, because obviously a lot of this is probably starting plants and indoor growing, do you have to do like a crop rotation like traditional farming does, where after a certain amount of use of a piece of land, you have to rotate it out with a different plant, or just as farrow soil, or how do you approach that?
I would just add more soil and regenerate the nutrient content in it. The way that cannabis works, we're not tapping in so far into the soil where we need to regenerate the earth beneath it, right? Our tap roots are like a foot and a half, you know what I mean? Our root balls get maybe 3 feet by 3 feet, stuff like that.
Okay.
And you're talking giant plants with a small root ball.
Yeah, so it's 10, 20 footers, right?
Yeah, you just put a bag of boost in there, till it in again, and you're ready to rock and roll.
Wow, that is impressive. I was kind of wondering, you know, I think one of those things you hear in Cub Scouts is like a tree's roots are always as wide as like the leaf pattern. You always kind of assume the tree of life looks the same upside down and right side up. But you're saying really there's not a whole lot of room in the bottom you need. You can get a lot of height out of a little bit of depth.
You can, absolutely. And so the feeder roots are always going to be, you know, pretty much the same footprint as the top of the plant, just like the tree of life, so to speak.
Okay.
But the root that holds it in place is going to be minimal compared to the size of the plant. Yeah.
Right on, right on. So thinking about maintaining the plant through its cycles, I remember I got to talk to one grower. He mentioned that they use like a team of mites that they kind of have to, much like living soil, sort of maintain, add to, and remove. Certainly, most people probably don't go that deep. I've heard neem oil be mentioned as a sort of friendly organic pesticide. What is your thoughts on pesticides? Well, how do you think the environment is best controlled against, you know, those pests that we don't want?
Well, prevention is key in any scenario where you're trying to produce clean cannabis, especially quality craft cannabis. And using predator mites is a great way to eliminate issues during transition and bloom. So definitely something I do is green lacewings. I use assassin bugs. I use Californicus and Andersoni predator mites at different times as the different temperatures and humidities change throughout the growing season, because you have to be specific with the mites that you're using so that they thrive in the environment you put them in, because they don't all work exactly the same.
When you first started growing cannabis, did you think you would get as far down as being able to name mites groups specifically as you do now?
No. So all that like came with the retail job, you know what I mean? Learning how to use these products, talk to the customers about them, you know, what to recommend, you know. It's a weird retail job because you're a consultant the whole time you're doing it, right?
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Questions, how do I grow? What do I do? Can you diagnose my plant? Can you look at some microscope? You know what I mean?
So I put a little thing to its heart. Yeah, it sounds good, you know?
Yeah, it sounds good, right? Exactly. And so you just learn over the years how to do all that. You know, you get good at it with experience. So after 15 years of growing and you know, 8 years of consulting, you know, it was finally time to start Canescape, which is my consulting company. And then to go right along with Good Earth Organics, you know, so that people can just call me up now and get like an entire service done, period. Like, I'm trying to start a grow. Can you help me? The answer is yes. How far do you want to go?
Yeah,
how much do you want to spend? And what's your time frame? Because we'll get it done for you. You know what I mean?
That's incredible. That is awesome to hear. Thinking as well. So one thing I heard from the one guy I mentioned who's sort of doing a little home grow, and it's relatively successful, but he and I both know there's areas where he's like, not really sure what made this happen, you know, and he sort of has to do just like you did, you know, learn through the behavior. Are there any other plants that synergize with cannabis that grow near it that can help it? He kind of mentioned this idea that sometimes you grow a plant one every X amount of room for a crop, and it can actually improve the crop either in the way it reproduces or just grows in general, or even the soil conditioning. So I was wondering, does cannabis synergize with anything? Awesome. I always hear tomato plants, but I never know what to believe.
Right. You know, tomato plants grow great, you know, near cannabis. I wouldn't grow them in the same row or pot necessarily. You don't want the roots competing for nutrients.
Okay. Right?
And tomatoes like nutrients as well. So they'll compete for nutrient content, and you don't necessarily want that. Now we do plant some companion plants like marigolds and other flowers like that help deter pests away. And so we plant those at the front of the pots or front of the rows in order to help keep the plants cleaner, deter pests from being there. As far as other companion plants go, it's mostly like cover crops that we would use beforehand. So we plant the cover crops like clover or mustard, things like that, to help the nitrogen content in the soil regenerate naturally, and you just till it back in before you plant. So that they work in synergistic forms like that. As far as growing anything else in the row or in the pot with it to work in a synergistic way, I would not do that. I wouldn't want anything stealing the nutrients from my cannabis plant.
You know, I hear a lot of that attitude, I think, from a lot of growers where they really think of it as individuals, whereas I think a lot of people are like, a crop, it's this many plants, and you just think of it as one unit, but each one is a person with its personality and its own sort of life cycle, which just makes me even more curious. So thinking of trichomes, as you mentioned, you know, the plant's defense, a word that means hair, I think, in Greek. Have you ever found, and sort of a shot in the dark, because I asked a couple of growers and they said they rarely get to have the labs when the plant exists, obviously. Labs always come post-harvest.
Right.
Have you ever found that there's a correlation between the tactics of grow, temperature, humidity, airflow, and the style of plant effects, you know, like the terpenes and cannabinoids? Does it ever seem like certain environmental factors produce terpenylene or limonene more often, or is it more the genetics, it seems, and you sort of let the plant be what it is?
I definitely feel like it's more genetics that deter what kind of terpenes are going to be in that plant.
Okay.
Now, you can definitely use things to bring out more trichromes in that plant to provide more terpene levels and things like that to make it bigger, brighter, tastier, smellier. One of the things we did these last 2 years to help us produce more trichromes and keep our plants cleaner, more mold-free, things like that, was a Brix product that we have called GEO Brix. And we used it alongside the veg and the bloom in order to increase the carbohydrate production in the soil and allow those terpenes to develop sooner in more abundance and on every cola that was there. And so our prevention methods when it comes to late harvest, things like that during the rainy seasons when you're going to get bud rot and things like that, we didn't really have a lot of that because the terpene production was at maximum, allowing the water not to get inside the plant, right? Mm. So the bud rot didn't happen so much.
Right on. So if the genetics seem like, again, and certainly I don't think we ever have the equipment next to each other to really see this test be performed in real time. I guess when hybridization occurs and you start doing crossing with plants, is it possible to tell with any genetics the idea that one plant is more dominant than the other, or is it purely just kind of throwing colors in and seeing what comes out?
Great question. I'm not a pheno hunter and have very little information when it comes to that. I do know that when you hybridize plants, they do a pheno hunt in order to get the one that produces the best mix of the two plants. And so they call those F2s, I think. And when they get that F2, that's really what you're going to find on the market for sale versus, you know what I mean? Like, oh, this one is indica dominant, sativa heavy, you know, some crazy thing like that. Like
Michael Reeves, your head.
Right. But I'm not a breeder and I'm not a genetics hunter. I like proven genetics, nothing experimental.
Yeah. Genetics is always a good thing.
Genetics, yeah, exactly.
Do you find, you know, as you said, if you can tinker with some factors and, you know, sometimes you see it can boost terpene or cannabinoid development earlier in the growth stage, does that come at a cost? Do you find that if it's like you get the one thing, are you like, oh, this is, we're going to be eating something later in the process where it's not as tall or not as bushy or something?
No, you don't really find that because the transition phase is really when the plant stops growing vertically and horizontally at its maximum rates. And so you should already be head high by the 4th of July before you even start eating. You get what I mean?
Like, I get you.
You have reached your maximum growth size that you're going for your footprint to allow yourself to say, okay, I'm getting 2 out of this. I'm getting 3 out of this. I'm getting 4 out of this. You know, obviously it comes with experience, years and years of growing to be able to tell what kind of consistency you're going to get out of your crop yield. Right. So.
Awesome. So a couple just last, if anything, big fish questions for you. What is the most responsibly that you've gotten off of a plant? You know, like what's the biggest number in weight that you've gotten out of a single stalk?
6 pounds is the biggest plant I've ever grown. I know people that have grown bigger ones and I'm just not interested in that amount of work to tell you. It's what a headache that plant was. You know, you're talking about a 12-foot by 12-foot plant that was
Christ. Like a cube ladders. Of just weed.
Yeah, on ladders trying to harvest it. You know, it's like that one plant took 2 days versus being able to do an entire row in a couple hours, you know? Right. And the bigger they are, the more of a headache they are. You know, the bigger they are, the larger you're the bee buds, the less production you have on the inside of the plant. Mm-hmm. You know, they look incredible. They really do. And they're awe-striking. You're like, oh my God, that's huge. The colas are like walking sticks, you know, stuff like that. And you just can't, they're just too much work. And the quality that they produce isn't the same kind of quality that you get out of a 3x3 foot plant that has incredibly hard nuggets on it and chose to produce great quality finishing product versus being the biggest plant you've ever grown.
You know, it kind of reminds me, a company on this coast that we have called Illadelf. It's a glass company. They tried to make a name for themselves probably 10 years ago, but it's always like in the corners of some people's minds. And I remember they made like an 8-foot bong. And sounds like your plant. It was like, it sounded great. It looked amazing, but you did have to get on a ladder to use it. And it was like, what's the point, man? Like you could have gotten a lot more done with a 1-footer at that point. So it kind of makes me think the same way. There is a limit to that response. Damn, right. 6 pounds on a plant. That is incredible. So to the audiences who may have been interested in growing, may already be growing, or maybe it's a far idea. has growing affected your relationship with the plant? Do you think it's pure benefit, just even attempting it so you understand more? Or would you say it's kind of hard for some only?
You know, that's a good question. I'm sure you've talked to many growers and asked them this question. It's a very symbiotic relationship between happiness and gardening, right? So you put your hands in soil and there's no better feeling. So growing these plants, you definitely go through a phase where you're like, wow, I feel like I'm learning from the plant. You feel like the plant is teaching you how to be calm, patient. You know, you have to wait 5 months for this thing to do its job, right? And you have to push it along its way. You have to hold its hand. You have to cut its hair. You know what I mean? You have to make sure that it's standing upright.
Stretch its limbs, right?
Stretch its limbs. Make it sure you teach it how to walk, right? You know, it's really like raising a child. You really get the love out of it when it starts to get back to you at the end. And then, you know, once you produce a good quality product that makes you feel good, you're like, wow, that's a full circle scenario. And then you look forward to doing it year after year.
Wow. You know, there's a couple of things in life, I think, that match that. I feel cooking can be seen the same way, you know, if you really taste what you put into it. But it's good for me, as I mentioned, you know, my mom, she actually moved over from Trinidad. We grow scorpion peppers in her kitchen. So it's the one thing where I was like, they look amazing. I will not touch them because I've read the Scoville units on them. And I always thought, you know, with her green thumbs and she's in her older years, maybe it'd be worth sitting down with it. So that to me, I've asked a couple of growers, they all seem to, it changes. Like you're not just a relationship, but like your personality with the plant, I feel like. And even from what you're saying, it's so much more respectful than just stealing the buds, right? And having a good time with it. So as a final question, before I let you get out of here, thinking of the whole world of soil growth, cannabis, legalization, regulations, what is the next thing that makes you excited? What are you waiting for to happen in this market? What's the next big thing around the corner?
For me, it's nationwide home grow. I think that everybody, America, the world, wherever, deserves to grow their own cannabis. Safe access to well-produced medicine is something that everybody lacks. And it's nice to see that many states are pushing their way through that. And one day, everybody will be able to do it. And I look forward to that day when accessibility and education meet each other in an organic way and everybody can grow their own.
That's amazing. Lee, I want to thank you very much for making the time. And this has been beneficial on so many levels. And I hope I can bug you in the future, have you back as we can update our knowledge and move forward with it as far as GrowTex with cannabis. So thanks again, my man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Scott. You know, please remind everybody to visit goodearthorganics.com. We have a learning labs up there and all kinds of educational things as well as good information on living soil.
And remember also, everybody, that Lee does consulting on the side. So if you have this massive grow, if you really just need to get your feet under you as far as understanding this, much like I've been doing this episode, be sure to find good and dependable people like Lee, because it's really a community of cannabis, I think. Just like a good crop of plants, even if it's not the same pot, we all interact together. So once again, thanks for coming on the show. For anybody, if you like what was said, make sure you check out goodearthorganics.com. If you like anything on this side of the microphone as well, you can hit me on Instagram at thecannabis.professor with any comments, concerns, or reactions. We'll be back with you in another week with another great show and topics. And I'll be looking forward to bothering Lee again about some soil and some dirt. Thanks again, Lee, and everybody out there. Actually, if anything, this is probably the first time my tagline is especially righteous. Remember to grow knowledge and extract truth. This is Lee and the Professor out.